Company of Makers. Podcast, talks, workshops.
This series is dedicated to those who served in Optelec and their families, marking the 20th anniversary of the commencement of operations. Each episode, we'll talk to members of the Armed Forces community who served in Optelec, or whose lives have been directly impacted. These are true life accounts, and these personal stories may be emotionally challenging to hear. If you feel you may be sensitive to this, you may prefer not to listen.
Welcome to Land, Sea and Air. I'm Steve Bomford, co-founder of Company of Makers.
And I'm Tip Cullen, an actor and former Royal Marines Commando.
And on this episode, we've got a chap called Kirk Bowett, who's also a fellow thespian, an actor.
Yeah, I would call him one of my wingmen as such. So we worked together on the play Soldier On, and we performed in Toronto together, which was a cracking, adventure. And it's a brilliant play. And with the Soldier Arts Academy, myself and Kirk, and a few of the rest of the team. So we had a great time. And to be honest, as soon as I met Kirk, I just knew, one, he's a great storyteller, but he's got an absolutely incredible story to tell.
So let's hear it. Kirk, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we're here to talk, as you know, about Optelec and the Iraq War. And I'm just wondering, you know, where were you? What are you doing? What regiment were you in when you first realised that that was going to be the next adventure, as it were, of your military career?
Yes, my regiment was a county infantry battalion called the Cheshire Regiment, now the Mercian Regiment in the Midlands. And we were very focused on Northern Ireland pre 9/11, and 9/11 being the turning point of most people in military services careers, and actually affected millions around the world. And we were coincidentally training in Jordan for a desert role as being the battalion in Cyprus. So we were in desert combats, old Gulf War I desert combats, and we've been out in the ranges shooting all day. And I remember walking back into the cookhouse tent where the guys were having a cup of tea, watching a small TV screen in the corner. And I thought was a movie on the telly. It was actually 9/11 happening on the news, and that changed our trajectory. You know, the domestic conflicts of Europe and Northern Ireland were now very quickly a thing of the past, and our future in the sandpit was ahead of us. And we actually didn't deploy on the main invasion. That was left to the high profile troops like the Marines and the Paras and the ones that were quick reaction forces. We rotated out of theatre and went back to the UK. But we returned on Operation Telic 4 in 2004. So that was about 14 months after the invasion had happened. It was a calm but dangerous period post conflict. So, as you can probably imagine, an invasion of a country happens where there's a conventional enemy. They retreat and the invading army takes over, and you know the enemy's in one direction. That had all happened, and the troops that took over the invading forces managed to catch Saddam Hussein up into Tikrit, near his hometown. And then there was a strange period of, what do we do next? And I remember we were training. This is how surreal the military training is. You're always training in the winter to fight the summer. So we found ourselves on the prairies in Canada in snow, training to go to a desert in Iraq in 40, 50 degree heat.
I don't know much about military training, but that doesn't sound right to me.
That just happens. It just happens. This weird, you know, you're training here and you're freezing cold and in your desert combats, and out you go. And I remember landing at Basra Airport, and as we circled to come into land, we were on it was a nighttime flight. We'd flown via Qatar on a jet, and then we transferred onto a C-130, a combat aircraft, body armor and helmets on, and we flew in before first light. And as the aircraft came in, it dropped out of the sky Force First Light, and chaff was launched from the aircraft, and you know, we knew we were in a combat zone by then. And as it taxied into landing, dawn was beginning to arrive, and you open the doors, this sweltering heat, and you could see fields of oil. And that's the irony. It's this fields of oil around the area, black lakes of oil, where you know, after the invasion, Saddam had sabotaged the wells and done all their bits, and there was oil everywhere. And the question started to arise as to why are we actually here? You know, what are we here for? And the mission briefings began, you know, to Cheshire's, we're going to become the Basra Battalion in the centre of the city. And we were going to, there was the Shia areas of the slums of the poor areas, and the Sunnis that lived in the rich areas in their villas, they'd all disappeared and whatnot as Saddam was overthrown, the Baathists were defeated. And we took over unit, and I was part of the recce element where we were taking over in Basra city itself. And it was Basra's what they call the Venice of the Middle East. It's it's on the Northern Arabian Gulf on the Shatarab waterway. There's canals up the streets, and these are not flowing canals. They are stagnant water, and they are orangey, greeny blobs of water with gases that come out of them. It's almost like something out of some sort of surreal, I don't know, Martian landscape. And the smells that come from it, it's got this very, at the time, I'm not sure it's like now, but it was a very smelly place because the infrastructure had failed. You know, there was no sanitation, no plumbing. The streets were full of rubbish. There were the dogs in the streets. There were destroyed houses. There'd been a war. There'd been an invasion. You know, all of the big infrastructure buildings that had been JDAM rocketed, where these precision rockets had gone through these big high-rise concrete blocks and destroyed them. And we were learning our patch, learning our AOR, and we had the Basra Palace, which was Saddam's old opulent palace down by the river. His big super yacht, his yacht had been scuppered in the waterway, and that was lay on its side. And we were initially met with open arms, really. The units before us were wearing berries. They still had their body armor on, and there's a lot of ideas of hearts and minds. We were given these footballs to hand out to the children, and there was ideas that we're going to go and make these football pitches in the communities, and the engineers were tasked to clear the streets of the rubbish, and you know, there were real positive ideas going on of what we could do and escort aid agencies around and wage paying organizations. A lot of the problems that we had, and you could see that was going to happen, was everything had stopped. The school teachers had stopped teaching. The police had disappeared. You know, we were trying to encourage people to put uniforms back on and come and protect their society. But bearing in mind that the police and army were all Sunnis in the south, they'd all disappeared back up north. And vice versa. So what Saddam had done is taking people from the north to police the south, and the south to police the north, and they could be a bit more, they could be strict and have that whole Sharia rule in place. So as the weeks and months progressed, we went from wearing berries and armor. There were small incidents that would happen, and they were pretty brutal. I've been in Northern Ireland and seen some, you know, horrendous things. And when you see the IRA plant a bomb, or, you know, we had the Omagh bombing happen, and I was 21 when that happened. And that was sort of a real shocker for me, seeing the incident and being involved in the aftermath. But there were some ones that really, really hit me. And one of them we had interpreters, and these brave young men would come to the bases, or we'd meet them near their houses. This is how stupid we were. We'd meet them on the street corner by their house, and they'd come on patrol with us, and they'd interpret bravely without mask or anything like that. And then before long, we'd go and to pick them up and find that they'd been killed. You know, you'd go and pick them up at 6 o'clock in the morning. You'd find their body on the street corner, and the real sinister element was beginning to rear its head. We were doing house assaults to try and capture the terrorists, and there where the militias were beginning to form because of this power vacuum and the lack of police. The Shia in the south were led by Muqtada al-Sadr from Baghdad, and they created these armed militias. And they were pretty, you know, organized. They had good weapons. They'd either picked up weapons from the caches that they'd been overrun by the invasion, or they were being armed, as we found later, by Iran. And they were planting precision IEDs. We had a water convoy, and it was called Operation Certain Death, where we'd go and collect these two water bowsers from the osmosis plant at the palace, and that would then trundle its way through the city to provide water to the bases, because we needed a lot of water for all of our troops, you know, washing, showering, cooking, drinking. And it started off in the first couple of months, so they would take pot shots at you from the estates. You know, everyone carries a rifle in their house. It's like the Wild West, and they're allowed to have a weapon in their house. And every now and again, a couple of rounds would come by, and you get into the base, and you know there'd be a few bullet holes in, and some of the water would be squirting out, and the quartermaster would come over with black tape and try and tape it back in or whatever. And then, shortly after we'd lost our first interpreter, we went to meet the logistics guys, and these were reservist guys. You know, they'd done reserve training. They were just lorry drivers in Simi Street, and they were in these just normal lorries, painted sandy color brown with grates on the windows. And I remember speaking to them and saying, you know, guys, good luck with the trip. And I got into my snatch wagon, which was the Northern Ireland. It's a Land Rover with just armor around it. It's nothing underneath it. And we were trundling our way through the streets, and I looked through the rearview mirror and saw the one of the lorries just lift off the ground. Boom, up it went. And the big cloud of smoke filled the street, and I knew the vehicle had been hit by an IED. So I ran out of my vehicle, ran to the cab of the lorry, and his door was already hanging over. He was sitting at my head height, and I looked up and I could see a leg, and I could see a thigh, and I was trying to get this leg and reattach it to the thigh like a Lego, you know, like a Lego toy, has broke his Lego toy. And then it clicked in, and he, you know, this guy, he needed first aid, he needed a tourniquet on. And, you know, the medics came over, we put a tourniquet on him, and I ran over to an open ground there's a red route, we call Red Route to the palace. And on one side of it is a house estate, on the other side is a big open palm plantation, which is now actually a park. It's now a theme park. And there was a clearing big enough where there was an old roundabout and some swings where you could land a helicopter. So we called in HLS, and I, you know, waved in a Lynx helicopter that was circling overhead. And the irony of war is, you know, the doors open, this helicopter, and a load of journalists and high-ranking military people with cameras got off, and it looked like they'd been on some sort of, you know, excursion. You know, they'd been out photographing, and I was going, get off, get off. And then Rank had gone out of the window by now. And
hang on,
like,
you've
get
just
off,
had,
get out. And
you've just had an IED hit your convoy, yeah, and you've obviously got someone seriously injured. What on earth was going through your mind when, that sounds more comedy than, you know, and surreal, doesn't it?
Surreal things happen. So what happened was because so many people mobilized to go to this war, you had basically a lot of civilians in uniform. We'd put parts of Basra out of bounds because they were so dangerous to go to. And you'd be in there, the next thing there'd be a Land Rover would drive past with four people in it, you know, taking photographs. And it's like, where'd they come from? You know, they didn't get the memo. You know, they didn't get the memo. They hadn't got with the picture, you know. Yeah. So I've bundled these, what we call battlefield tourists, off, and then we had to strip all of the seating out of the aircraft to get the casualty in and get him away for medical treatment. And it was really early days in us understanding what real hostile conflict is. You know, we roll on Iraq and Afghanistan later on. We'd learned a lot of lessons by then, but there were so many mistakes made in the early days. But that was our real understanding that actually we weren't in a place that was going to get more peaceful. It was only going to be dangerous. So it was helmets back on after that. Mm-hmm. And then we stopped certain vehicles hitting the streets, like the soft skin Land Rovers. We couldn't let out the bases anymore. So we really upped the ante. We used to do it in Northern Ireland in the big cities when things kicked off. It would be, we only use certain equipment in this area. And you know, it was big boys rules this time. And we could come back into base after an incident happened, and you could watch it on the news. You could switch Sky News on in the crew room. We had our satellite dish rigged up, and you could watch yourselves on TV. It was all so kinetic and so quick. It was almost like we're on a stage. We were on this weird stage, that international stage that was going on. And that's when... So we were based in Bath Party headquarters, which is right in the middle of the city. This is Fortress. And the Bath Party were like a secret police, and they would take and torture people. And actually, our accommodation was the torture chambers with the ring, the chains on the walls. And we had our cots in this chamber where there was a grill in the floor and a hose in the corner. And we knew this is where they torture people.
Now, so that's a nice home from home, isn't it?
It was. What was good about it, though, it was hard cover. It was a concrete building. The other company, they had tentage outside, and every time we were mortared, they had to run into the Jadan building, which was already, you know, not in a very safe position. So I was happy to be in a torture chamber because I had a foot of concrete above me. So these little pros and cons of war. What we had a rumour of, though, and the tour after the invasion, one of the regiments, I think it was the Queen's Lancashire Regiment, they'd killed a prisoner. Baha Musa had been killed in detention. They put a sandbag over his head, and he'd suffocated or overheated. So this was rumbling in the local community. There was a definite hatred for what was going on in the base that we were in, even though our unit hadn't done it personally. They don't understand that units change out. And back in the UK, a load of footage had appeared in the Mirror newspaper of British soldiers torturing prisoners. Now, when you look at the imagery, it looks very staged, and there was a lot of conjecture about it being staged. But Piers Morgan, in his infinite wisdom, decided to go ahead and publish this media, and that got on social media, and that got to Basra on the Friday morning. And when the imams called for prayer, that created an anger and a hatred towards us that created what we call Sada Saturday. And Sada Saturday was a nationwide attack on coalition forces, where it was the same incident that Bahari won the VC and Woods won his MC up in Alamara. We had the same down in Basra. We'd been resupplying Alamara a couple of weeks earlier on a long convoy. And I was guard commander in the fortress, down in the guard room next to the entrance to the Bath Party headquarters. We had this Saxon armored car. It was like a stopper, and people could walk in. But if a suicide bomber was to come, it would hit the armored vehicle rather than us. And straight above the building, we had a Sanger with my machine gunner on, and there was about nine other Sangers around the base. And I'd gone. It was about 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, and I'd gone for a quick shave because I wanted to keep up as a commander. You have to keep up appearances and whatnot. So I'd gone for a quick lick with the razor blade rifle over my shoulder. And as I was walking back towards the guard room, all hell broke loose, you know, tracer rounds flying overhead, and RPG hit the front of the wall outside the building. My 2IC ran out to help a team come into the building, and he had blood all over his face. And I ran up into the Sanger, and the Sanger was on an exposed ladder. So I'm climbing up a ladder with tracer rounds flying past me, and crawling into the Sanger to try and get an eyes on where the enemy were firing from. And they were across a canal at three or four points at these bridges, and we were trying to engage. And that was the first big firefight that I've been in my career. And it made me realise that it's not a peacekeeping thing. It's a borderline war that we're in. It's a start-stop war. The QRF that had been out, they'd been out on a normal routine patrol. They'd come back in, and their Land Rovers were full of brass, you know, link and brass and all this sort of stuff. And the guys were a bit shook up because an RPG had gone through the net of the vehicle, right between the legs of the top cover guy. And that was when we decided those vehicles, we're not using them again, because it was we were using chicken wire and putting the Hessian around it to make it look like armor. That's how ridiculous it was. We had no equipment.
Wow.
So we continued, and the base that we were in, the commanders came down and they decided that we were going to close the base down and move out to the edge of the city. And this is the most ridiculous idea, because tactically it was actually a fortress that dominated the city. And lo and behold, you know, we withdrew, and then the 2 months later, after the militia took over the fortress, the unit had to go and take it back again with an advance to contact, you know, at the risk of everybody's lives. So, and these are the ironies of war. When you look back at like Vietnam or, you know, the Korean, there's always these ridiculous decisions made at a high ranking level where the people now have to go back with their own lives and undo the decision that was made.
Yeah.
I was due to leave then. I was due to go back to the UK to train recruits. So I left after that, I think my unit were there for about another month or so. They had a few more incidents with snipers and the militia, and a few guys won awards from that one. And that was my first, what I say, introduction to the sandpit and life as a soldier working out in the Middle East. And apart from the environment trying to kill us, you know, you're sitting in 40, 50 degree heat with body armor and helmets trying to glug water every day, and you get caught out on a checkpoint or caught out with an IED, guys were going to go down. And I remember being borderline heat stroke with guys, and the kit and equipment just wasn't, you know, we had Northern Ireland snatch wagons, you know, is that sort of kit. So I rotated out of theatre, went back and trained recruits for a while. We returned back to Iraq about 2.5 years later. And this was more, we'd actually pulled out of Basra by then to the airport. And the units were trained to support the special forces in strike operations. They were going in, yep, and lifting key targets. It's more like a targeted thing. And that was when Al-Qaeda had started to do rear their ugly head as well. Rotating out from that, the regiment then went to Afghanistan. I lost 12 mates. I lost 12 friends in a 3-month period. And I'd served about 18 years by then, and I decided I'm getting out of the army now. I've had enough. And the burnout of post 9/11 wars had started to really hit the combat troops. You know, you had guys that had been in for 10, 12, 14 years on their second and third tours, and, you know, they may have had a marriage breakdown. Some guys were definitely beginning to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder and incidents, you know, that. And, you know, having buried 6 or 7 of my friends, you know, the intimate part of going to the family's homes, and these were guys that I knew as a young 18-year-old soldier, and, you know, actually putting them in the ground, that for me was closure enough on my time as an infantry soldier. And it was really, it was a surreal end to it all. It was almost like I was having I was saying goodbye to my own career. And then I was in Civvy Street now with 18 years served with all this experience under my belt, not really knowing where to go. In the peak of recession in 2010, I picked up some security work domestically, but it certainly wasn't going to pay anything more than rent. And I wanted to make a difference for my wife and young child. And I find myself training as a close protection officer and returning to the Middle East as a bodyguard. So in 2011, I find myself back in Iraq.
How did you feel, Kirk? You've obviously just talked about, you know, losing friends. You know, you've had some skirmishes and encounters whilst there in the army. How did you feel about going back?
I knew there was unfinished business in Iraq. You know, I'd made some friends out of there. I knew the terrain. I knew I'd been following what had been going on, and the amount of investment that we put into the country, you know, trying to bring around democracy and, you know, trying to bring elections about, getting Maliki in power as the prime minister. I was hopeful that it was going to become a better place. you know, and even in a soft posture, my work as a close protection officer would be more a fly on the wall, you know, facilitating meetings, escorting aid agencies, right, looking after diplomats, getting them around the country. You know, it was only going to make the place better. You know, and if I could get maybe 5 years down the line and get to the point of my body armor and helmet being off and me wearing a suit with a pistol tucked down my pants, that would be the ultimate goal, you know. And also it was a pinnacle of my career because I was now in a position where I was out there because I wanted to be out there. I wasn't being told to go down roads by some young lieutenant who was on his first tour. And he just followed a load of doctrine that wasn't working. And if something was going to go wrong, it was my choice. I was a commander and leader in my own right. And we were doing some, you know, pretty crazy stuff. We were going nationwide, you know, and when you talk about Iraq as a country, it's pretty big. You know, it's a good 6-7 hour drive down south from Baghdad, you know, and an 8 hour drive north. It's a, you know, it's double the length of the UK. And each different region's got its own problems. You know, you've got the up in the north towards Kirkuk, you've got the interface with the Kurds where there's lots of volatility going on even now. Down south in Basra with the Arabs, you know, in that melting pot down there, you've got over in the west towards Syria, you know, where the Sunni enclaves were post the invasion, they'd all moved back to their own towns, and what you found is Iraq had realigned back to all of these tribes had gone back to their own hubs.
Yeah.
Which was to later create a big problem, because I'd gone out there and we took over from the American troops because Barack Obama was insistent on having his troops out by December 2012. So we called 2013 the year of Christmas dinners, because what the Yanks did leave behind was all of their Christmas dinners what's the celebration they do?
Thanksgiving.
Yeah. So our base received about six of these reefer freezer containers, and they were just full of chicken turkey dinners. So the guys just had turkey dinner to live on for about a year and a half, which was funny. It didn't do good for the these young Gurkha lads, and they put loads of weight on, so we had to get them in the gym. But we were doing some really interesting work. You know, we were out in the Arabian Gulf, out to the oil platforms on Seahawk helicopters. We were traveling up with the convoys up and through the country. I was in Baghdad on diplomatic meetings with various embassies, oil and gas, aid agencies. I could see we were making a big difference. You know, I was at some of the clients would be oil and gas companies that would come in promising to build them power stations in areas that didn't have power. You know, you could see where I ended up working up on the Iranian border, this small village that started out with two cars. You know, within a couple of years, you know, most families had a car, and then most families were able to have mobile phones, and then they had phone signal, and then 4G network was coming in, and they could communicate. And my local nationals in my CP team were adding me on Facebook, and you know, you could feel it modernizing. And I'd fly through Dubai and show them pictures of Dubai and say, "Look, your country could be like this. You have the wealth under your ground to be this wealthy country." But one of the problems with Iraq is the corruption, you know, where it sits geopolitically. You know, the Iranians don't want it to succeed. You know, the Turks don't want it to succeed. The Saudi, they want to pull their own bit, and it's like this, you know, that everyone's pulling at all angles and creating infighting and corruption because it's at this crossroads in cultures, and its own problems live within its own borders. And again, we didn't realize this when the invasion happened and we overthrew Saddam, it was going to unplug all of the cement holding these bricks together.
So he was opening Pandora's box, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was this brutal cement that held it all together. And, you know, we're still reading from it now. There's still that volatility. So the American troops withdrew in by Christmas. And I remember saying goodbye to them guys, and they thought they were going back to the States. But later, one of my friends told me they were getting forward mounted to Afghanistan, which goes with the flow. And then into 2013, you know, I was nationwide, you know, 6-7 hour missions down south, staying in villas, going up north, picking clients up for the airport, in a routine, going on leave to see the family, changing our lives back home, and built, you know, getting a house paid and earning a decent salary for what the risk was. And then things started to take a turn for the worst. And I remember being sat on a briefing one day with my team, and I projected the map on the wall in the ops room and pointed out to a place just west of Baghdad near Abu Ghraib. We were going to take a client. And one of my teammates, his face went white as a sheet. And he said, "Oh, Mr. Kirk, Mushkula, we can't go there." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because Daesh. And I said, "What do you mean, Daesh?" They said, "This means hypocrite. They are hypocrites in Arabic, and it's basically extremists," which later obviously became ISIS. Because what was happening in Syria, you could see Antonov planes flying over from Iran. These were arming Assad. They were taking Assad, his weapons, to fight the Free Syrian Army. And these gangs, hordes, were coming across the borders into Anbar province, and they were taking over towns, decapitating people, you know, raping and pillaging. And my local nationals, because they now had Facebook, they could see this glossy footage. They could see this amazing glossy 4K media of these hooded men chopping people's heads off. And it was so effective, the Iraqi army ran away. You know, this Iraqi army that we trained on their new Abrams tanks and Humvees, they simply ran off. They ran to Baghdad and created this corridor that ISIS were moving through. So things really ramped up in the country, and a lot of people, you know, quite rightly needed to be taken out of the country. You know, we had a lot of people there for business reasons, and to get them out for the time being would have been good. So we found the next few weeks really hectic. 16-hour missions, you know, up in the morning, you know, 8-hour drive here, drop the clients off, down there, drop the clients off, go there, pick people up. And I just remember, look at the calendar, look at my leave is in 2 days' time. I'm due to go on leave. You know, I'm ready to go, a bit of a break, and then reconsider my options. And we've been given this mission in the morning to lift a load of clients from the airport to get them out of the country. 4-vehicle convoy, and these were armored Land Cruisers. So they're quite discreet looking, Toyota Land Cruisers that are quite popular out there. But they had armored glass, armored windscreens. We had body armor and rifles and pistols and all of the right kit and equipment and radios. And we'd spread out in the open convoys in the open country. We'd spread out. And then in the urban environments, we'd close right up and schnurgle through like a snake. And the guys were very well trained. I mean, even the local national guys, they've been close protection drivers for about 4 or 5 years already, quite a few of them. Multilingual, you know, knew the people. They were very competent guys, which was very surprising when I first went on the contract. And we dropped a load of clients at the airport and run our way back to base. Everyone was absolutely shattered. And we had a long desert road ahead of us and about a 2-hour drive to the base, where I knew there was a hot shower, clean sheets and some fresh food and a couple of checkpoints. And these checkpoints were like a chicane in the desert. There was, some Wrigley tin and Tesco walls that the Americans have put in, and they hadn't been manned for weeks, which is great for us because it meant we didn't need to be stopped. Every time we stopped, it would be more vulnerable. And we just chicane through these things. And I remember approaching this checkpoint, and ahead of me, you could see pickup trucks, and these pickup trucks had people with guns, and they weren't police and they weren't army. They were somebody else. And I remember saying to Edan, go, put your foot down. And Edan puts his foot down, and our vehicle goes through, and I call on the radio, and we're committed. You know, our vehicle chicanes through the checkpoint, second vehicle through. I'm looking, I've tilted the rearview mirror to me now so I can see behind. Third vehicle through, fourth vehicle through, and I'm like, crikey, who the hell are they? I don't recognise who they are. They were definitely a militia of some sort. And we'd seen these militias at a distance in the cities. They'd always have flags everywhere, and you just narrowly avoid them, and they were on the move and you were on the move. And I looked through the rearview mirror, seeing the first vehicle, and then debris hit the side of my vehicle, and my tire and my wheel came up and flew into the air, and the vehicle went from about 60 miles an hour straight forward to sideways on, flying through the air. And as the offside wheels, which was Edan's side, which were to the left, hit the road, the vehicle began to tumble. and it tumbled like a bread barrel. You know, the doors ripping off with the weight of the armor in them, the roof ripped off. And it, my 2IC Gary explained to me that it rolled about five or six times and it popped like a cork. And I remember rolling the vehicle and being hit a number of times over the head by the debris, the weapon, the ammo tin, bang, 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 knocked unconscious. And then still and calm. And I remember opening my eyes and feeling excruciating pain down my arm where it had been crushed, what had happened. I'd hold onto the seat with my right arm. And as I saw the road come to the windscreen, I instantly reacted with putting my left arm to the ceiling, to the roof of the vehicle. And the armoured glass, which is about an inch thick, coming in and trying to pull my arm from the vehicle and pulling me out. But my body armor, and my seatbelt kept me in place. And as I came to, I could feel and smell the dust and feel the heat of the sun on my face. And I was thinking, why is the sun on my face? And I looked up and I could see the sky. Where's the roof gone? And I grabbed the door because I knew that I needed to get out of the vehicle. That's a big target. I need to get out of the vehicle. So I reached the door and there was no door there. And as I stepped out, I stepped on my right leg. My foot went one way and my leg had went the other because the shock wave that had come up my side of the vehicle had shattered my tibia and fibula. And I was basically on a floppy leg. And the excruciating pain knocked me to the floor. And I ended up laying face down in the desert sand. And I'm telling my mind, I'm telling my brain, move. Come on, Kurt, move your body. Now, and it wouldn't move. You know, I've been in some dangerous places before in my career, and I was always fit and you know, robust. You know, I could dodge, you know, dodge a bullet, but because I could at least take cover. This time I wasn't moving. I wasn't moving anywhere. You know, my body, it was like the computer. You put the program into the computer and it just ain't responding. It's an error. And I'd never been so vulnerable in all of my life, lay face down in that desert sand, you know, thousands of miles away from home. And, you know, knowing there's no helicopter coming, knowing that there's no Pedro or MERT team coming because it was a ground extraction. And we know that when the Americans have pulled out. But my team kicked into action. The three other vehicles responded. They provided all-round defence. And Gary and one of the teammates came over and grabbed me into the back of their truck. And we bombed off at a right angle across the desert. And they set a bearing for the clinic, which was about a two-hour drive away. And we bombed off. And I'm in the back of this vehicle in the fetal position, in and out of consciousness, clinging to life. And the medic's leaning over, giving me sips of water out of the top of the lid of a bottle just to wet my lips. And they're saying, stay with us, Kirk, stay with us. And my senses are shutting down. I'm going blind. I'm going deaf. I can't feel him pinching me anymore. I'm unconscious. And I'm saying goodbye. And then I come to. The pain was making me feel, it was making me vomit. But there was nothing to vomit. Mm. And it was like the body's response that the amount of pain was making me want to stick the pain up. Wow. But the adrenaline that was caused because of the vomiting action was able to numb the pain. And it's just amazing to see the body's response to it, you know. I felt my fingers on my crushed arm because it was still there. And my fingers were crunchy. And I knew that at that time that my hand was gone. It was definitely going to have to come off. I fell unconscious a couple more times, and I remember the second or third time I fell unconscious flying above the vehicle, almost like a kite above the vehicles as they're bombing through the desert. And it's in perfect 4K vision. I'm looking down at the vehicles, and they've got a choice. They can go left to this small clinic or right to the hospital. And they chose to go the wrong way initially, and I'm rapping on the window to Gary saying, "You're going the wrong way." Now, how could I know that being lay in the fetal position in the back of the vehicle? But later, the guys told me that they did. They initially went to the wrong clinic. Wow. So dusk's arriving now, there's a couple of porters outside the back of the hospital with they've got orange jumpsuits on and they're smoking cigarettes, and all hell breaks loose. The three vehicles pull up and a stretcher's pulled out, and I'm bailed onto a stretcher and into surgery straight away. And the Iraqi surgeon, it's a not, a, I would say, a first world clinic. It's a little bit of a butcher's shop. There's tiled walls and a grate in the floor where they wash the blood away. And I remember sitting there being filled full of morphine until I'm numb as a sheet, and then going over and grabbing the saw and, you know, suturing, taking the razor to my arm and amputating my arm in front of my eyes. And,
good God. You know,
I just knew I was in a better place. I knew I was in somewhere that smelt like a hospital, and I knew the guy was doing the best he could for me. And I could see in the corner, Pete with a pistol down his pants guarding the doorway. And they guarded me that evening till about 3 a.m. They said, "We're going to smuggle you up to Baghdad to keep you out of the way of the militia, because we don't want any follow-ups, and we're going to put you in the back of a small ambulance, and there's a private jet waiting for you, and we'll whisk you back to the UK for primary care." And they did, and it was a, you know, quick trip to the airport onto this stretcher on this private jet. It was absolutely amazing. And zip up we went, you know, 7 or 8 hours later, we landed at Marshall's Airfield in Cambridge, and I'm into Addenbrooke's Hospital, which is, you know, one of the best hospitals in the country. I couldn't be in better hands. I go in for surgery on my ankle that day, and then the afternoon I'm in my own room on the ward. And I'm lay there in bed. My wife's visited, and she didn't even recognise who I was at first. But after the visits were over, I was able to compose myself and laying on the hospital bed, looking out the window at the blue English sky and seeing the tops of green trees and hearing the birds singing outside the window, just feeling at peace and feeling the cool breeze coming in that I'd not felt for months. And then I scuffled myself to the edge of the bed and sat upright, and I could see across in the mirror on the sink. I got the first glimpse of myself, and there was no I kind of completely understand why my wife didn't recognize me. My head had swollen like a potato, my eyes were bloodshot red like I'd had a fight with the devil, and I looked down at my arm and I was disgusted with myself. I just said, "Look at the state of you. You know, you've got one arm and this stump that's covered in stitches and, you know, broken ribs and lacerations all over your head." And then I just was overcome with the feeling of joy that I was alive. And I pinched my cheek and looked in the mirror and felt the pain of my pinch and said, "Kirk, you're alive.
Yeah,
you're bloody alive." So I made a point then. I said, "Right, I need to tell everybody I'm okay." And I remember when we medevaced a few of our colleagues in the Middle East previously. But once your teammate's been on medevac, there's a big vacuum in the team. It's like a bereavement, even though you don't know what there's no closure. You see them in a very bad way. They get chucked on the helicopter and off they go, and there's a real hole in the team. And I needed to tell the guys back in theatre I was okay. So I sat back on the bed and paid the money for the internet in the hospital, and I'm on Facebook, and I'm talking to some of the Iraqis, lads in Arabic, and translating. But then Gary finally pops up on the Facebook Messenger, and he said, "Oh, Kirk, you know, I'm so glad you're alive." And I said, "You know, Gary, you guys saved my life. You know, you put the neck brace on and you tourniquet, and you all did everything right, and you got me out of there." And we talked about Edan, who had been my driver, who had been killed instantly, and he'd been taken to Karbala and buried that evening, which is what they do in Shia culture. And then he turned around to me and said, "What do you want me to do with your arm?" I said, "What do you mean? What do you want me to do with your arm? It's 2 days ago now. What the heck?" He said, "No, I've got your arm here. What do you want me to do with it?" I said, "What? How the hell have you got my arm?" He said, "Well, the surgeon couldn't dispose of it because you're a Christian, and that was a Muslim clinic. They dispose of body parts like a funeral, and your body part couldn't go in the grave there. So he gave it me back in a hazmat tub, and it's been sat in the truck for 2 days. And when the guys came to clean it out after the mission, they say, 'Hey, Mr. Gary, I find this, and my hand's in there.'" And I was already in enough trouble with the wife as it was. So I said, "Gary, do me a favour, can you get my wedding ring off it for me, please?" So he did. He got his Leathermans and pulled the wedding ring off my arm, and they took it into the desert, and it's now buried along Route Tampa, and I've got a 10-figure grid reference for it. So I will make a pilgrimage to it one day. I'll go and dig it up and I'll put it in a picture frame on the wall at home.
Wow.
So I was introduced to BLESMA, which is the Limbus Ex-Servicemen's Association. I'd never heard of them before. I've been in military service, you know, and working around military for now coming on 20 years. I did the Legion, but BLESMA were unique, and these were the charity that, you know, look after the people with physical limbs missing. And I was discharged from hospital. I learned how to walk again by wading up and down a swimming pool, and I was struggling for an identity now. You know, as a limbless ex-serviceman, I was, where do I fit in society?
Yeah.
I was able to go on a trip to Colorado with a team of guys, and I asked them while they were out there, you know, what do you do now? And bearing in mind, compared to these guys, I'm just a scratch. You know, there's people with two legs missing, triple amputees, and a couple of them have been in Fury with Brad Pitt as extras, you know, rolling around on set as stuntmen. And I thought, oh, I'll give that a go. So I signed up for a couple of casting agencies and found myself on Wonder Woman with Gal Gadot when I got back. And Goodbye, Christopher Robin. I did a stunt in that one. And I then did a bit of Game of Thrones and was able to be a stormtrooper. It was great. And it was really fun. I was going on set at 6 a.m. and finishing at 10 o'clock at night. And it was almost like being back in a military environment, working with some really interesting people, you know. And I got the idea. I wanted to work in theatre and film, and it was great. I spent a period of time through the Poppy Factory. I was working in London for a disaster recovery company, and it was the usual, you know, hustle at dawn, commute into London, sit in an office for 12-hour days, and we were rescuing people from around the world. We dealt with the Ebola crisis, very high-profile stuff, quite stressful stuff, really. And I remember standing on the platform at Peterborough Station watching this guy, and every day he'd stand at the same point on the platform, and it sent heckles up my back. And I thought, gosh, you know, he's one step away from stepping off that platform, this guy, and I've watched him for 6 months. And that day I quit my job. I went to the office and said, hey, I'm quitting my job. And the boss, he said, what do you mean? It's the end of your probation. We're about to give you a pay rise and, you know, give you a full-time role. And I said, hey, now I'm done with London. I'm going to call it. And I went home to my wife and told her that I quit my job. And she blew her top. What do you mean you've quit your job? I said, I've quit my job. I don't want to work in London anymore. The house is bought and paid for, isn't it? Well, this is not like you. You've changed. And this is where the cracks in the relationship are beginning to show. I was now no longer the Kirk that she used to know. Because I'd had brain trauma and my personality had changed. You know, I was no longer this focused, you know, dedicated, focused guy on one thing, career-minded, career-orientated. I wanted to do different things. I wanted to change things. I wanted different risks. And it didn't sit very well with her. She didn't know this guy that she was living with. And I then went to look after the military training areas in East Anglia, the rifle ranges and the training areas. And I found myself drinking really heavily to the point where I'd go and work on the ranges with the soldiers in the daytime and then, you know, sink a crate of beers and go to the pub and drink till getting kicked out of the pub. And instead of going home, I'd sleep on the sofa at the range. And I think about 4 or 5 months had passed when my colleague turned around to me and said, Kirk, you're going to go home at some point. And I said, what? Oh, home, yeah. Oh, the messages have stopped. We're not communicating anymore. Oh, I'm homeless. Oh, my God, I'm homeless. And I was homeless.
I ended up homeless. What were you thinking at that point? Because you've kind of, dare I say it, done this to yourself, haven't you, in the sense that you haven't gone home. What was that moment of realization like that had happened?
It was my values didn't align with that person anymore. We fell out. I'd actually done a game show. I'd been on Hunted on Channel 4. I miss a bit. And there was £100,000 up for grabs. And I wanted to donate it to the charity, yet my wife at the time didn't want to do it. She didn't want to be involved. And I said, you know, after all the charity you've done for us, I want to go and do this. And we had we were both on different paths. And I went into a period of I was self-destruct, I guess. I just wanted to drink and it wasn't just my own injuries. I wasn't, because life had slowed down somewhat after service, because military service is so fast, you don't get a chance to dwell and think about what happened in the past. It wasn't just my own incident. It was what had happened during my military service, what had happened in Northern Ireland, and what had happened in Iraq, and losing my 12 mates in Afghanistan. And it was all coming home to me, and I was pushing so many people away. You know, this people want to help, but how can they know? Mm. You know, how do they understand? And then you feel like they're patronising you because you're now a problem. And I would, many, you know, I'd be in the streets of Cambridge, you know, a very affluent, well-to-do town, and I was this isolated person on the streets of Cambridge and living on a rifle range on a military training area. And I tried my best to make the relationship work, and we decided to go on a holiday to Bognor Regis. I drove down and with the children in this caravan. It was only a budget holiday. It was fun. But the first week I thought, I'll behave myself. Things will be great. We'll be all right. We'll get back together. I'll move back in, and, you know, we'll live happily ever after as I'd planned to. And then about four or five days in, we went to the kids club. And then after that was a disco. And then somebody across the room had noticed I had my arm missing. He said, "Oh, you're a veteran, are you, mate? Can I buy you a drink?" Mm-hmm. And then we drank, and my wife and I drank, and we're both heavy drinkers because we're both ex-forces. And we had a blazing, blazing row. You know, plates were thrown across the room. There was arguments and shouting. And I woke up in the morning with a blazing hangover on the sofa. And I looked into the bedrooms, and they'd gone. And I looked out the curtains of the caravan, the car had gone, and I was there in, you know, in Bognor Regis on my own. And I immediately panicked, and I grabbed the car keys and drove back to Cambridgeshire, where the house was, you know, 6 hour drive, 5 hour drive. And I got to the house, and there was nobody there. And then I went back to my work, and I got to work, and I was, oh my God, I've left my wallet at the caravan. Oh my God, you know, I've left my phone. I just panicked and got in the car, and I knew that I had to drive back down to Bognor Regis to go and get my wallet and my phone. And I remember driving down past the M25 and onto the M3, and it was getting to the early evening now, and, you know, it was getting darker, and car lights were on, headlights were on, and the fuel gauge on the car was hitting empty. And I knew that I had to pull over because there was no fuel left in the car. And I pulled up on a lay-by and went for a walk on a bridge overlooking the motorway. And I remember standing on the bridge looking down at the vehicles moving underneath, thinking, this is it, I'm on empty. You know, the amount of fuel, amount of options, amount of, you know, and I was thinking about calling it a day. You know, I was thinking about jumping over, and a police car pulled up. And a police officer got out and said, you know, you're okay. And he got my attention, and they ushered me into the police car, and they took me to the local A&E. I sat in A&E in a prop chair, not being seen, because the people in the A&E on this Saturday night were far more needy than I was. You know, we had people with psychosis in there. There were people with physical injury, and I was just in a very dark place. The way I explain it was almost like you got vertigo, where you stood over a big walkway and there's nothing below you, you know, that sort of feeling. And it's debilitating, it really is. I'd suffered bits of depression in the months leading up to it, and the drink really not helping that, you know, you get drunk and you have the hangover, and, you know, you have the regret and this, that and the other, and it's the negative part of it. But the blank darkness of not even being able to enjoy music, you know, switching really good music on that you love and not being happy to it, or singing to a lyric, or enjoying food, a good meal, or, you know, all these things. It was like everything was numb.
Yeah.
And I can understand somebody suffering from depression. It doesn't matter what you do for them, their mind is not engaged in what's going on now. It's because their mind is somewhere else. Their mind is either in the past or the future, or it's not here in the present. It's not here in the moment. It's not here in enjoying now. So I was signposted to counselling, and Blesma, the Limerick Veterans, helped me get some counselling, and I went into a period of counselling and able to talk about all of my life, my childhood, going right back. You know, that's where it starts, not having a dad, You know, my dad, who was an alcoholic, dying when I was three, you know, he was life and soul of the party in the local pub, and, you know, went on a fishing trip with his mates, and four of them died in a drink driving accident, which was quite common in the early 80s. It was like a sport in them days. My joining the military, I guess, was a part of my search for a father figure.
Mm.
And then me following the counselling, making a few rules about my future and doing the right thing, and definitely getting back in touch with my children, because I am a lonely person, and my loneliness is from pushing people away. But the people that cure that loneliness is my children. And it took me a while to realise how important they are. I'd gone on to study creative media at BFBS and got into working as a location manager for Netflix on Bridgerton. And I was working really long days. I'd moved onto a narrowboat in London by then. And I got onto a plane with Tip, actually. We were both out in Toronto. And everyone but Tip caught COVID. I know, he's invincible, that man. And I flew back from there, and lockdown kicked in, and my freelance work dried up.
Yeah.
And I made a beeline to get back to my children, because they were my anchor. You know, my daughter Tilly and my son Bertie, and this is what gets me to here now. You know, I am physically in the edge of Lincolnshire in Grantham, because it's within 50 minutes of my children. You know, I can get to see them every other weekend because they keep me going. They don't understand how much they keep me going, you know. So they're my reason for being, and everything else that plugs that gap is you know, it pays the bills to get me to see them at the weekends that I see them, you know. And I've been very lucky. After lockdown, I managed to land a job with the MOD as a survival instructor at RAF Cranwell, and I've been doing that for nearly 3 years now. There was a few pitfalls in there. I started to talk about my own experiences a bit too much, and that started to bring back a few of the demons. But my colleagues were very, very mindful of that.
Mm.
But it's allowed me to explore the survival and resilience journey. You know, what gets somebody through an extreme traumatic period physically, or even it's just a health, you know, health condition.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's got their own extremes, and then what the post trauma period's like. You know, some things might come back and bite you in the butt a couple of years down the line, and what are you doing to keep that demon at bay, and understanding your weaknesses and flaws, and that's what's helped me write.
Kurt, before we started recording this, we obviously were talking about all of this, and we've, you know, talked a few times, obviously, for me to better understand your story. But you did sort of mention about the fact about having to learn to be a father because of obviously your experiences with your own dad. Well, not obviously, that's what you told me, your experiences with your own dad. But I think the interesting thing is there that kind of is that learning to be a father helping you in the way that, you know, that's that learning experience is part of it, as well as obviously loving your children.
Yeah, it's a part. I suppose part of the next phase in life. I'm 44 now, you know, and you know, I can't be Peter Pan forever, you know. And the value and importance in. I mean, we chose to have a family to bring that next chapter about in our lives, and, you know, encourage our children to grow. But because I never had a father. And I'm sure there's lots of people out there that have had a single parent, and very, very, very somebody who's of the same sex that you can emulate or mirror, or not. In that case, you know, some people might have dreadful parents that they choose not to be. So I chose this amalgamation of TV characters. A couple of, you know, my grandfather was great, but he was a World War II veteran, but he passed away shortly after me joined the military, and it was. It's taking those the sweet bits of them and trying to be the best I can be for my children, but then trying not to be too perfect, because you set yourself up for a fail, don't you? It's understanding your flaws.
Yeah,
you know, one thing I certainly hit on the head around my kids was drinking, you know, drinking alcohol, you know, being drunk around your children again. It's just not, because it's just going to make them do it, isn't it? They're just going to do what you did.
Yeah.
You know, and I've definitely learned from that, you know, and do it because I've moved to a new town. It's being brave enough to be a part of the community, you know, joining local groups, joining the scout group. My son and I do the scouts, which is fantastic. Every other weekend we do that. I joined the theatre group here to keep my thespian love going, you know, just to keep challenging challenge the confidence muscle, as you call it.
Yeah.
You know, and that helps with the public speaking. I managed to do a school talk locally here in Grantham on Monday. They'd just come back from half term, and only one child fainted from my story. So I'm slacking, aren't I, Steve? There should be more.
You need to make sure they have breakfast before they listen to your talk.
Yeah, a combination of breakfast and me talking about fingers as if the cheesy Watsits probably didn't help.
Yeah, no, probably not. So I think, you know, you're on a journey still, aren't you? I think that's what I'm hearing. And I think, so what does the future hold, do you think, Kirk? Because you have written a couple of books as well. Let's not just, you know.
Yeah, what does the future hold? I mean, there's two things. I made the mistake of saying yes to too many things. And when I said yes to too many opportunities, I ended up with no life. It had all fallen apart. I was on this roller coaster of a journey with no stability. I was on to the next opportunity, next opportunity, next opportunity. And not having a stability of a bit of routine in my life where I get every other weekend off or every weekend off to see my kids, that I've learned is important. Mm. So what lies ahead is watching my children grow up, you know, and being a part of that. Continuing to write. I definitely want to continue to write about survival, and I want to write about the post-trauma journey and how we can use the performing arts, art, communication, you know, in that, you know, keeping the message public.
Yeah.
You know, veterans have had quite a bit of it's been a bit of stereotype about veterans, hasn't there? We know we've been put in this pigeonhole, and you know, you get these, oh, look at them all over there. They're, you know, the violent, the drunk, and or they've got it on a plate. Look at that. But what we should be at the stage now is championing veterans who are doing well out the back of it.
Yeah.
You know, can they be role models in society going forward?
And for other for other veterans, and to explore.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, it's not an often career pathway that you go from, you know, very kinetic deployments in, you know, Iraq and Afghan, and then end up being an actor or whatever it might be. It's like the same with Tip. It's not an obvious choice, but I think there are an awful lot of people who have served in those recent conflicts that are making a success in the creative industries. And I think, you know, as you know, we're really passionate about.
We're creative people at heart. The combat troops, the guys and girls that end up in combat have to be creative because they have to think on their feet and be dynamic.
Yeah,
you know, but the military system stifles that. The military system wants structure, order, discipline, and you know, everything's in a straight line and beige and magnolia and do whatever. But when it actually comes to the crunch, it involves you having to think colourfully and do colourful things. Now, the military, it'll nurture it to a certain degree, but it's scared of it because it doesn't know its potential. Because there's some amazing potential out there. I mean, these people that won the Victoria Crosses and military crosses, they did it because they decided to do something inspirational. You know, they decided to go into their hearts and throw away all of the rules and go and do something extraordinary. Yeah. You know, and if we can do something extraordinary within our own communities, whether that be write a play, write a poem, act on stage where you get a standing ovation, or you make people cry, you know, because we can, because we've had it ourselves, and I think a lot of people lie. People live difficult lives, but sharing the message of what's actually going out there in the world, you know, sharing the stories of one of my loves now is watching survival stories, you know, of how the hell did that person get through that. You know, and you're seeing that journey and seeing that human resilience, seeing them get through it. And if I can act it, play it, write it, do it, sing it, then I'm going to do it. And it makes you feel good, doesn't it? It makes you feel good.
It does, but it's also drawing on those experiences, so they have value as well. You know, I mean, it's not all been entirely negative. They've been difficult experiences, but they're not all entirely negative. And I think if you can draw on that to express yourself creatively, that's got to be a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always the silver lining, isn't there, on the end of it, and you can, you know, there's not much that I can see in my life that will shock me, you know, and so that, there's a huge sense of resilience out of the back of that. Mm. So there's a lot of people in society that struggle with resilience because they've not been exposed to any extremes, and we've got generations of young adults coming through now that are really struggling because they haven't had an adversity. Mm. They haven't had an extreme happen, and when it does happen to them, it absolutely kiboshes them, you know, it knocks them for six, you know, because I was brought up by World War II grandparents, pretty much, that they roll with the punches. You know, they rolled with it. They, you know, that things were a bit frugal. They saved the food remains and made a hot pot or a stew out of it, you know, or did a bit of DIY if the washing machine broke, or, you know, it's all of that. Whereas, so I see it, and you know that young man who fainted in my talk. I wonder whether he was stronger because of it. Wonder if he became stronger after experiencing that, those feelings and emotions that made him faint. You know.
Well, that is a question worth answering. I think you should ask the school to see, and also see what the other children thought, because it's a fool by learns by their own mistakes and a wise man that learns by others, or something to that effect, isn't it? So sharing that experience. Yeah. But I guess someone's got to have the experience themselves to be able to tell others. But, you know,
the feedback's very important.
Yeah.
We need feedback in our lives. Another thing that I've struggled with being a man that's lived on my own for a period of time is feedback, getting feedback, because we spoke about this in other conversations about men of 30s, 40s and 50s who are on their own in a modern society struggle to find a place to voice and openly talk about what they think inside their heads, because it might offend or it's not fitting the narrative of society at the moment. And there's definitely that going on. There's not enough of men of our age, you know, having a platform.
Fine, it's a forum to have a discussion, isn't it? And that's what does that look like? And it's, I think the internet probably contributes to that problem, because it's really easy not to leave your house, you know. And if you are on your own, that is challenging. But I think, you know, if people are feeling, you know, in any way similar to some of the experiences that you've been talking about, reaching out and just talking to your mates is absolutely a first place to start, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah, yeah. But there, being brave enough to say I need help, mm. you know. I did a public declaration the other day about saying I was lonely, and I had so many messages in my PMs where other friends that I wouldn't think were lonely are.
Yeah.
And it's a funny thing. It's a hard thing to pinpoint. You know, people say lonely. Oh, you're lonely because people aren't talking to you. It's like you can be surrounded by people and be lonely.
Yeah.
You know, it's that thing. And it's definitely for a veteran community, when you are get back with your old buddies and muckers and friends, that helps. That really does help. So cherishing them. And actually, I'm going for a veterans breakfast tomorrow in Lincoln. So that'll be really nice. I'll enjoy that couple of hours with my Lincolnshire veteran friends. I can't wait to see and meet new veterans there.
Perfect. I think that's the perfect way to end this, Kurt. I just want to say thank you so much for sharing that, because I know there's a lot of difficult issues there, and you know, life takes its very unexpected turns. And I think your candor, if there are others listening that can learn from this, it's been a job well done. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Now, Before Steve and Tip chat about what we've just heard, you may be interested to know that here at Company of Makers, we've got loads of online activities for veterans to get involved in. As well as this podcast, we've got online talks with inspiring guests. And we've got workshops where you can have a go at things like drawing, writing and photography. To register your interest, just head over to companyofmakers.com/workshops. Now, back to Steve and Tip.
Well, that's another interesting story from Optelec, isn't it? I'm really taken by the diversity of what Kirk's been involved in since he left the army.
Yeah, for me, Kirk's story is, I know he's a friend of mine, but it's very much a soldier's story. So his aspirational life for what he wanted as a young man was for those adventures and to become a professional soldier. And once he stepped onto that journey, he followed it for quite a while. And even to the extent of, you think about it, you know, youth adventurism, joining the army, being part of, like, you know, fighting in wars, battles, life-threatening things. And then after that, they become a mercenary. There might be some certain level of romantic attraction to that. But also maybe it's the fact is that after cheating death for so long, you now will get paid so much more money to do it, even though you're doing it maybe for purely financial reasons, maybe not for the love of your country, which again is quite, you know, that's got to be a, should we say, an emotive point for people to actually think about. But also you haven't got the same support that you would have on the ground from all the normal sort of elements you have in a military campaign. But to do that with maybe, and I said this before, just maybe a bit of dysfunctional reason that this will pay the bills. And a lot of people say, well, no, it's not dysfunctional. That is the reason. We're doing it to pay the bills. So you're getting paid for doing a not dissimilar job from what he was doing serving for the UK military, but getting paid a hell of a lot more money for it. So that's something, or the reason behind that is something I can't really answer. But that journey was impacted not only by a sense of adventure, but by those experiences or the trauma he's exposed to, those experiences of his and his professionalism as a military person, as a soldier, have obviously led him into different things, and you know, which possibly would never have got into had he not been exposed to those initial operations.
I think that's very likely, but you know, he's got skills, hasn't he, which were useful, you know, in the private sector. And I think there was an opportunity and he took it. And whilst I'm sure he thought he was doing the right thing at the time, you know, there were consequences for him, weren't there? As he tells us, you know, his story as a contractor when he lost his arm is you know, he was pretty close to shuffling off, shall we say.
Oh, no, completely. And I think that the way he tells the story, but also it lends into possibly the journey that's brought him into the creative world, but is, you know, the story he tells about being sort of like leaving his body and looking down on top of, you know, that movement. I think for all of us, you know, we never know, do we? So it's just that element that he gives a definitely integrity, you know, to that journey. But just what if and, you know, higher, what happens and all that. So he told it incredibly, but believably, you know, because the fact is he's done this has happened. He has got that story. And I think it's a completely unique one, especially when it comes to the stage where you say, oh yeah, my arm's buried in the middle of the desert and I've got a 10-figure grid. That, I mean, and we've had a couple of beers with me and Kirk about it, but it's just, it is quite a unique sort of just episode, isn't it? It's incredible. But the way it's affected him moving back into society and the trials and tribulations, whoa, you know, challenges, you know, ongoing, but, you know, from that very moment, the highs and lows become, I'd say, so much more highs and lows. So it becomes harder to get yourself back. I feel it would be harder to get yourself back on an even keel, but he has so much positivity. And for him, the glass is always half full. And I that has helped him so much to go through an extremely challenging period.
Mm. I'm not sure how you respond to someone who says, I've still got your arm here.
Yeah.
I just wasn't expecting that. And obviously he wanted his wedding ring. And from that point onwards, obviously his life had changed. And it's like you say, it's the things he's gone on to, isn't it? The acting, which I think is how you met him.
Yeah, I mean, the acting, but and his creative world. But he also, he submerged himself back into his local sort of like, you know, he does Amdram, you know, he's back in that community. He's, you know, striving to be important, to be a mentor to his children and also for young people in the community. And that's got to be positive. And that's got to, you know, be, as a person, that level of kindness, so that level of, I think it's responsibility, you know, feedback into society, that gives you, I think that's very therapeutic, but also you're making a positive impact on society again. I think that's important for a lot of veterans.
Yeah. And I think, you know, he alludes to it, doesn't he? You know, how his relationship with his wife and therefore his family kind of broke down as a result of experiences. But now he's completely focused. You can hear it in his voice when he talks about his kids as well. That is something, you know, he didn't say this, but I'm pretty sure that's what's keeping him going. He's got that his children to look after, to bring up, and that's his focus. And that's what's providing that some of that momentum, I think.
No, but it does. But it gives him that sense of purpose of what he's doing, what his life is, why he's doing his job, which is an incredible job. He's a published author as well, so he's making books. So he's not somebody that sits on his backside, which is incredible. He's completely moving forward, despite, you know, his arm loss, his experiences. You know, he's hitting well above, you know, expectation, I suppose, considered expectation of you know, an injured veteran. He doesn't. He's not measured by that by whatsoever. So he's acting, doing professional acting. He's doing Amdram. He's, you know, he's a SEER instructor. He's a survival instructor with the RAF. You know, these are incredible, responsible roles. And he's doing it. He's can doing it consistently as well, which is important, I think, for himself as well.
Yeah. But that's got to be offset, hasn't it, by some of the challenges that life's presented. You know, when he realised he'd made himself homeless, when he had that moment on the bridge, when, you know, the police officer came up to him, thank heavens for the police officer. I think, you know, he's had some lows in there, and I think it's how he's, you're right in terms of, you know, how he's expressing himself now. And I think that's helping him cope. And I think that's really important, but I still think, you know, we all need support from time to time. I don't think that's a bad thing. And I think, you know, life throws these curves ball at us, and there are ups and downs, aren't there?
Oh, no, completely. And he's, again, across the board of the, you know, our guests and that support is the thing that can make or break the whole situation. Just that ability to communicate with somebody, have a chat, discuss it. But obviously, and some of us do need it, including myself, we need guidance, a bit of signposting and moving through that to get the support where it's, you know, where it's needed. And but also with Kirk's story as well, he's taken ownership. He's had that support, that guidance, you know, there's probably life-saving intervention at some stage, but he's obviously taken it on board, and he owns it again. He's moving forward. But again, it's regret is a powerful word, you know, about, you know, thing. But if it's behind us, I think regret can be wasted, really. It's a wasted emotion, because the fact is that you have to move forward and draw the positivity from the good and the bad from your previous life, because it's never going to change. And if you hold on to that regret, I think that's a negative to you as an individual. I think, you know, it could be a passing sort of like regret. You know, for me personally, I would allow that, but you cannot sort of rest on it, because if you rest on it, it's going to be, you know, negative to your whole mindset. And Kirk hasn't allowed that. He's moved forward. You know, and he's mindful. He did use the word mindful. He's mindful of moving forward. And he also respects people that are mindful of where he's come from and what he's been through. And, but the challenge he had through relationship and all sorts, we have to understand it. That's not unique. That is something that like happens from, you know, that just that let's say, reintroduction with somebody who you've been apart from a long time. That's a challenge, but it happens. But then again, there's friction that could be made or created from your experiences and operations, and also friction that could be created or not by your absence, you know, with what's left behind. So these are things that if you can't overcome them, and in a lot of respects, this has happened before, that's where, you know, that could be, and I wouldn't say feel, that's where those relationships part. They part, you know, and it's got to be a certain level of positivity in both ends to make them, you know, still, you know, to make them, shall we say, acceptable for any children involved and bring them forward. And again, I'm not saying that as a trained person. I'm saying it just as a human being, or, you know, the examples I've seen and from friends and, you know, personal experience.
Yeah. And reconnecting with his family. I think that was a key message for him. I just want to come back to the acting side of things, because that's your gig. What is it about acting, you know, being on stage or on film that you what does that bring to your sort of well-being and purpose, a sense of identity? How does that help?
I mean, it's right. For me, acting is storytelling. It's a bit like listening to our people's stories on our tele podcast here. It's, you know, it's storytelling. I think it's such a human aspect of just being human. It is the, you know, I mean, we've told stories since day one, week one, since we were, you know, the Guinness advert for the two little like things come out. Since that part of evolution, they've been spinning dits and telling stories since then. So we can't, you know, it's always part of it. And you think even that relationship or that need to communicate with somebody, that's the important thing of therapy as well, of moving people forward. So everything's about communication, storytelling, you know, even opening up and telling your story could be a form of therapy. When it comes to acting and performing, if you map across your skills as a service person that's going to go, right, what am I going to do? For me, it was, I wanted to be a storyteller and I was looking at creative writing. But when it came around to it, there was an acting course to train as an actor, do a 3-year degree course and train as a professional actor. And I looked at that, and that for me is probably the most apposite method of storytelling for me as a service person. For me, you know, definitely, but for the service people, that storytelling can be done through the myriad of the arts. But acting sort of like, and as soon as I met Kirk and so many other veteran actors, we come, you know, there's similar reasons for it, not all the same, but similar reasons is why we're actors. And also, I think it's a bit enlightening when you join the industry and become like a professional actor, that you realize that the structure of all these environments you work in, although it's complete, it's artistic, it's, you know, we're all lovies, as the saying goes, that, but when you get in that environment, it is very much quite, you know, discreet and maybe not as robust, but it's very much, they've got layers of military life. You know, if you're in a company, you know, a theatre company, it's called a company. You could be in a company of soldiers. You're in a theatre company. You know, all their, shall we say, the terminology is very similar. You have to perform. You're measured on your performance as a soldier. Mm. You know, you rehearse. That's a simple. You rehearse as a soldier. You're in a theater of operations, you're in a theater of, you know, of magic. It's all very the same terminology, but also it's a structure. You've got a director. What is your director? You've got your producer. You know, is that the CO? Is that the ops officer? You've got your G4s. You have locations. Maybe you're doing film. You've got people working, you know, behind, you know, back of house and front of house. All but have got like an important job to create the journey, which is the same as their military structure. So rather than being polar opposites, it's just extremely, and I never thought that initially. Remember, I'm a storyteller, but the environments are very, very similar, obviously with the fundamental difference that involves real violence or life or death situations, you know what I mean? And one doesn't. So, you know, I mean, that is the polar difference. Everything else is very, very, very like.
So we're talking about really here people being able to express themselves, aren't we? I think, you know, through storytelling. Yeah. So whether it's poetry, which I guess is a story or a feeling, or whether it's writing a book or a screenplay or getting on stage, the power of creativity is well, I wouldn't say we've chosen people to come on this podcast because they've done that. In fact, in most cases, it's kind of been discovered, having spoken to a potential guest and they, oh, by the way, they also happen to be a poet or an actor or something like that. It's like, okay. So it's quite interesting to hear and hear from other people and their experience of creativity and how finding ways to express the stories within have a power in terms of, you know, probably giving you a purpose and maybe a resilience.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but I think it's also, you know, when we, I mean, you know, I think we spoke about it previously, it's just that when you impart whatever you've got in that creative like environment, whatever you impart it, it belongs to somebody else. So you're communicating it as well. So in a way, your expression, whatever way through whatever, you know, creative process, it's important something. So it leaves you and becomes into the open form. I think that maybe is the healing process is getting it out of, you know, instead of just being in you. And that when you express it, whatever way you express it, it's out there. So really, you don't no longer, it's not solely or, you know, exclusively owned by you. It's now owned by other people, and other people can maybe assist if required.
Mm. Yeah. And talking of assistance, he's received assistance, hasn't he? He's worked with Blesmer. He's a member of Blesmer. And I think, again, we just want to highlight that there is support out there. And there are other service charities that can help with many of the challenges of, you know, life on Civvy Street.
Oh, not completely. And I think even Kirk's at that part of his journey where he supports all these charities, but also he sees himself as a, you know, even his writing is about survival practically, but survival mentally as well and psychologically, so life survival. So that's an important thing. And he sees himself, you know, being a role model, hopefully his experiences and telling his stories, because he does do, you know, public speaking as well and supports that, that he can, if somebody can take away something like that, that will help them in their life and give them, like, you know, a goal, a target, or a form of an avenue that they can pursue to, for their well-being. I think, you know, he knows that listening to his story, he might, you know, empower people in some way.
Mm. And that, you know, talking about public speaking, he did that talk in a local school. So, you know, a bit like Neville, you know, finding ways to support young people or share those stories or the experiences he's acquired to inspire or, you know, encourage young people to think about things differently, perhaps.
Yeah. And I think as a class, especially when you speak to young people, if it's not the sort of like the normal person in authority or the parent, they're sometimes they listen more to their, you know, their gives the old uncle or granddad or grandmother or whatever, and they get, you know, their direction. But somebody out of it, especially with the story that, I mean, the classic is, I mean, Kirk says, oh, yeah, what? And one of them, you know, they burst into tears or whatever, or they almost sick or something like that.
Fainted. I think he said fainted.
Yeah, but you're, when that happens, it's, and especially because it is quite a, I know it's quite a glamorous story. This is somebody who's been on a, you know, an adventure, you know, around the globe. He's had his arm lost. And I think, you know, really that is very impactful for young people's ears. And I think it's got to be positive if, like you say, he comes across, and he does when he speaks so positively, they will latch on to that. And I think it's, especially with impressionable young ears, that gives them that little bit of, you know, iconic sort of mentorship for just, you know, positivity in the way forward.
Mm. Yeah, I couldn't agree anymore. But also I think a top tip is making sure that every youngster's had their breakfast before they listen to Kirk on one of his talks.
The thing is as well, I think it's, when I do chat to Kirk, is when he has that little giggle before he says something about it and going, you know, you're going, yeah, that's comedy value, that is.
Where would we be without humour?
Yeah, indeed.
Thank you very much, Tip.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Kirk.
Before you go, if you're a member of the Armed Forces community and need support with your mental health, Op Courage can help. Use the link in this podcast description for details. Or you can phone the Combat Stress Helpline on 0800 138 1619. If you'd like to contact us, email studio@companyofmakers.com.
Finally, we're giving a really big shout out to our funders, the Royal Navy and Royal Marines Charity, and the Armed Forces Covenant Fund Trust. Thank you.
This podcast was produced by Rachel Owen, hosted by Tip Cullen and me, recorded and edited by yours truly.
Company of Makers. Podcast Talks Workshops.